Welcome to the Not Unreasonable podcast hosted by me, David Wright. This is a show of interviews with people who have something to teach us about managing our businesses and ourselves. There's a lot to learn out there, folks, so let's get to work. My guest today is Ken Brandt, co-president of Global Underwriting for TransRe. Ken started his reinsurance career at Employers Reinsurance Corporation in 1993 as a facultative underwriter. He held a number of management positions in the U.S. and Europe and was president of the Americas and Asia Pacific division prior to joining TransRe in 2006. Since joining TransRe, he launched and led the formation of their direct team, later led the North American underwriting team and the Americas team, and now runs underwriting globally along with Paul Bonney. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thanks, David.
So we're recording this on June 3rd, 2020, amidst significant turmoil in the United States between the COVID-19 epidemic and now rioting across the country, extraordinary stuff in the last week. There is a real big range of potential outcomes here, both for our society and also in particular for the reinsurance and insurance industry. Seems like it could go a lot of different ways, and it will take a little time to play out. What I'm wondering about is your position as senior management at a global reinsurance company. What do you think of as the best realistic market scenario for TransRe over the next couple of years?
That's actually an easier question, I'm sure, than more questions that you're going to ask. I think our best and now I think more realistic market scenario is we actually get paid appropriately for the exposures we're taking on. And that hasn't really been happening over the last 3, 4, 5 years. You know, for the past handful of years, the reinsurance market has become very soft across almost all business lines. And the soft market obviously also applied to the insurance market, but reinsurance returns, I think, were particularly weak. I think it's reasonable to say that in a quote-unquote normal cat year, whatever that is, but a normal level of cat losses, reinsurance was a low to mid single digit ROE business. And you know, that's just not adequate for the exposures we're taking on, and it's certainly not sustainable for a long period of time. And by the way, we haven't had a normal cat year in some time. So 2017, 18, 19, and now 20, you know, we're in the middle of a lot of cats. So over the next couple of years, I'm actually pretty bullish. While I can't predict cat activity, I'm pretty bullish that there'll be solid reinsurance opportunities that allow us to actually price it for the exposures we're taking on, and that there's good insurance pricing momentum in the market, and there'll be reinsurance pricing momentum, and the opportunity to provide our customers with quality reinsurance solutions at a fair price is probably better now than it has been in the last decade.
Why?
Well, that's a good question. Why? We it's not like someone woke up and announced, you know, let's all turn the market together. Mm-hmm. It's coming from pain and anticipated pain. So if you look at what was happening pre-pandemic, the market was already moving in several large areas, particularly in the U.S., particularly in casualty lines, D&O, public D&O lines. You know, original market rates were going up 20 to 30%, according to our customers. Reinsurance terms weren't really improving that much, but certainly the insurance market was moving rapidly. And it was doing so because of a couple of obvious dynamics. The first one is investment yields are historically low, and now post-pandemic, they're going to get even lower. That the ability to recognize positive loss development was diminishing, if not disappearing. And there's just a tremendous amount of, I think, loss, casualty loss, particularly in the pipeline that was coming through and will continue to come through, particularly if you look at accident years, 2013, 14 through 18, there's a lot of loss to be recognized. And so when you listen to different earnings calls and articles, people talk about social inflation, or you can say it's just loss development or good old-fashioned under-reserving, there's a lot of loss to recognize in the system, I think, coming through. And so the market was moving on those particular dynamics. Again, mainly in the U.S., mainly in casualty D&O lines. Property had been moving, even in reinsurance, but not as much as we'd like. So these things were already in motion. I think what COVID does and this is obviously just my opinion, but what COVID does is it creates a market that experts told me would never happen again. And that is, there'll never be another broad-based hard market. Hmm. And that's no longer true, right? COVID shows that the world is phenomenally connected in a lot of ways, and losses are going to hit from COVID on a lot of product lines, not just property, not just event cancellation. And it's global. It's not just one part of the world. And so I think the response to that, the response to the unknowns of how all this resolves, is going to push what was going to be a harder market. It's going to push it harder, and it's going to likely sustain it longer.
So this is a funny situation, and this is kind of one of the things that I'm just totally fascinated by, is in anticipating, let's call it better pricing, let's just say better pricing in the next couple of years, it kind of also means you're anticipating a lot of losses, right? Yeah. And I wonder sometimes about kind of the relative magnitudes of that, you know, like, does the pricing firming up actually kind of in a sense pay for the losses that have come in, or is it a net negative, or could it be a net negative? I don't know if you have an opinion on that, but yeah. It strikes me as ironic to be looking forward to losses.
Yeah, well, you know, the saying "your mileage may vary" comes to mind.
Sure.
That answer, I think it's going to be insurance company and reinsurance company specific. So let's continue to talk about the casualty market. If you were a market that ramped up your writings of, let's say, large casualty or excess casualty over the last 5 years, and perhaps you set your loss ratio picks at, shall we say, optimistic levels, you're in for a lot of pain. Right. No avoiding, right? If you are a market that was participating in the casualty arena, but chose to shrink your exposure over that same period of time, and you know, perhaps you're a little more conservative or realistic on the loss ratios, well, you're still going to have pain for sure. But right. You know, it's obviously going to be a big difference between the second example and the first example. So I think it's going to differ. I think you're right that they're you know, from pain comes pleasure or whatever. There's going to be a lot of pain, but it's going to not be distributed consistently across the market.
And when you said experts predicting no more broad-based hard markets, tell me more about that. So what would be, argue against yourself for a second there, right? So yeah. I think that from your comment there, I suspect that you were a skeptic of that assertion. But what is the case for, you know, let's say 6 months ago, for no more broad-based hard markets?
Well, I think that I use the word expert cynically, I guess, but I never believe that. I think that the market has a cycle, always will have a cycle. I remember years ago when they said, you know, a lot of articles about the cycle is dead, and the cycle is never dead. But it becomes fashionable to say that at some point in the cycle because it seems to be interminably long.
Right.
So, you know, if you look at property, just as a property cat as an example, property cat's been pretty frustrating and challenging and interesting and fascinating, all wrapped up in into one. We definitely don't think that the property cat rate levels, again, 6 months ago, a year ago, were adequate for the exposures. And I think that was proven time and time again. That involves the injection of the capital markets into that product line. It involves a 10-year run of unbelievable profitability on property cat, and so kind of hard to get off that drug for some, maybe. It has a lot of dynamics going into it. But there does seem to be a perception that in that particular market with respect to the cycle, that, you know, property cat is, I think, supposed to be considered a global commodity where you kind of fill your aggregate worldwide and take the benefit of diversification. And, you know, maybe there's a cat in Florida, but Japan has a good year, or, you know, vice versa. And that market was deteriorating also because it was no longer being treated as a market. And, you know, so if Florida had cat losses, Europe didn't want to hear about it. we're fine. We don't have European exposure or Florida exposures. We expect our rates to be flat or going down. Or if Japan had their loss problems, you know, the U.S. didn't want to pay for it, so on and so forth. So it became very tribal, very regional. And that's not how you can run a property cat portfolio. So it affects that cycle. And coming out of COVID, coming out of lots of cat losses, you know, there's an argument that could be made that the retro market has been seized up. So all these things are connected, that there's a lot of trapped capital in that market, that now it feels more like it's going to be it's going to return to a global commodity and a global cycle where rates have to go up. Again, in my opinion, really across the board on cat, whether you're a continental European, a Japanese market, or a U.S. market.
What do you think those rates are signaling? You know, if you look at like some financial theory, which, you know, so I was trained as an actuary, and they say your rates should be the forward looking expected cost of the claims you're going to get from running this contract, right? And that's consistent with financial theory, where you take a stock, what's like discounted value of the cash flows, and bang, that's what your stock price should be. Now, if European rates go up because of a Florida hurricane, what's the mechanism what does the price tell us? Does the price tell us anything, or am I overthinking this? What are you, any thoughts on this?
Does the price of what tell you
the price of European cat? So like COVID happens, European cat prices go up. What is that telling us? Is it telling us anything? Or is there a way to interpret that price signal from like a kind of quasi academic perspective?
I don't know if I can give you a quasi academic answer to that question. You know, all I would say is that it recognizes that the capital associated with the property cat market is global. It's
right.
You're not raising German capital to cover German cat risk. Mm-hmm. It's global capital. And so when that global capital spreads that around the globe to get diversification benefit, there are events or large event that affects that overall return on capital, then, you know, everyone has to pay. Yeah. So I remember visiting Florida a couple of years ago. It was after the 17 and 18 losses. And, you know, I said, you know, what are your reinsurance rate expectations? And I think the client, with all genuineness, said 5% or something. And unfortunately, I think he was probably right. That's how it worked for the real. But, you know, and I said, well, you know, what about this loss? What about that loss? And, you know, he said, well, you know, I don't think that affects my book. You know, I want to be treated, you know, independently on my book. Sure. And obviously he was putting his best foot forward to get a successful renewal, but that's just not how you can price a cat portfolio. Right. So I don't think that's an answer to your question, but I do think cat more than anything else is a very global market and needs to stop acting regionally or reacting regionally and start reacting globally.
Yeah, I think it actually is a great answer, because it says, another way of putting it maybe is to say the cost of capital goes up. And then that seems to me to beg the question sometimes of, well, what were they paying for in the first place, right? And so I was a reinsurance broker for many years, so I've been part of this debate too, Ken. So we're kind of replaying it a little bit for the audience. But I think it is interesting because, you know, there's this, you know, you were charging me a whole bunch of money last year, and now you're going to charge me more money next year, even though nothing changed with me, because your cost of capital went up. Does that mean you got it wrong?
Right.
So is there a certain amount of loss that's like baked into the price?
Yeah. I mean, we have not gotten it right, and nor will we get it right. I mean, you are an actuary, right? So you will be the first one to admit that when an actuary gives you a loss projection, the only thing they can tell you with certainty is that that loss projection is incorrect, right? Higher or lower or whatever, right? So I lost my train of thought there, but if you think about the property cat market, and if it continue to be regional, I would have that same meeting with that same client in Florida after a Florida loss and say, well, bad news for you, because now you're going to have to face the brunt of the loss.
Yeah.
But the other thing I wanted to mention is, you know, listen, every cat seems to be a new surprise, right?
Right.
So that's hard to price in, or if you do price it in, it's hard for the market to pay that price for unknowns. But if you look at property cat from my vantage point, I mean, there's kind of three buckets of loss. There's the ones that we expect and have experience with and try to price to the best of our abilities. So that's like wind and quake and fire, right? So we're comfortable with that. We're comfortable, if you can ever be comfortable, taking losses on that and making adjustments and not overreacting. And then there's a group of coverages that we know are in there. We just haven't been paying that much attention to. Wildfire, right?
Sure.
Flood. You know, so coverages like that, you could riot, civil commotion, right? So we know the coverages are there. There's no denying that. But have we really been modeling them correctly? Have we really been pricing them correctly and thinking about our exposures? And so those tend to be strong reactions post-event, like wildfire. Hmm. And then there's a third group of, I'm going to call it coverages, but they're not. And that's stuff that we never intended to cover.
Right.
We knew the exposure existed, but it was not our intention to cover this. So therefore, we didn't price it. We didn't factor it into our overall portfolio exposures. And that's stuff like cyber and pandemic. So, you know, it's depending kind of where the loss is coming from, that determine how the market reacts to a certain extent. You get an earthquake or hurricane, even beyond the model expectations, I think there's a more rational response, or at least a more confident response in the pricing. You get losses on wildfire and you're burning down entire towns, you get a much more, you know, vigorous response in your pricing. You get losses from silent cyber or now potentially global pandemics where you weren't expecting to provide coverage, you're going to get another probably stronger response on that.
So when folks are saying COVID's going to trigger a broad-based hard market, then with that interpretation there might be, we're going to get losses from COVID. We weren't expecting anything like COVID. Who was? We don't really know where those losses are going to come from as a result. And so we just aren't sure what we're sitting on yet. And until we figure that out, we won't know how to price it in. So we're just going to have to pad these suckers for a while. Is that?
Yeah. Well, I mean that I don't reject that thesis other than the word pad, because I don't know if you are padding it, right? You might be.
Right. Under. Sure. Sure. Yeah. And well, yeah, you're licking your finger and throw it in the air being like, I guess we'll do this.
Right. So by definition, if you don't know how it's all going to settle, it's certainly very, very difficult to price and assess. And everyone's going to have to kind of draw their own conclusions about their own portfolios, you know, and, you know, stuff like how does event cancellation, how is that as a market going forward? I don't know.
Yeah.
Right. I don't have the answer to that versus some other lines that you're just going to be able to work through. Right. And maybe it's price, maybe it's coverage, you know, but probably a easier solution than other lines. You know,
go ahead. No, finish, please. Go ahead.
I was just going to say the biggest unknown or the biggest danger or the business potential exposure has been written about incessantly now is the business interruption on property.
Yeah.
And that's really going to have to have – that's going to have a lot of ramifications, and it's going to have a, I think, a relatively early solution before we even know what the business interruption losses are, because it's going to be a key ingredient to getting the economies back.
There's this. I was talking to a guy in my town here who owns a climbing gym, right? So he's in the fitness industry. Pretty empty place right now, his business. And he's, you know, going through all the things that we've read about, right? So payroll, it's all part-time employees and they're all gone. And, you know, he's taking out one of these loans and stuff. And he said, you know, he said the loans are a terrible way to do this and enact this policy. What they should have done was they should have legislated payouts on the BI and then just nationalize all the insurance companies.
Yeah,
as kind of an elegant. I hadn't actually thought of that yet. I was like, whoa.
Yeah. And he voted for Bernie Sanders in the primaries.
You know, I don't think he did, because I think he was coming from. I'm gonna give him credit here. Okay, so I'm gonna say. Okay. So if you think like just super duper, like just logic chain, you know, it does kind of make sense, right? Because you don't need to actually apply for something listen, you know, I don't know how much you've dealt with the government, probably a fair bit since you're running a reinsurance company. You know, it's not exactly straightforward all the way to get access to this stuff. Yeah. But you do know you have an insurance policy. And if the government says, we're just going to pay all the BI claims, right, for everybody, and that just winds up being just a cash transfer mechanism. Right. And I think there's a lot of like very important complexity as to kind of, well, how does this exactly work? That maybe is the reason why we haven't done it. But it was simple. And what struck me about that was suddenly, you know, in a time of extraordinary crisis, right, it's like you can just get commandeered. You know, it's like a cop pulling a gun on you saying, I need this car. And you give him your car and he goes chases after the bad guy. Like I've seen in movies. I don't know if that really happens. But, you know, that in theory could happen to any asset in society.
Yeah, well, without a doubt, and has happened in history. And
yes,
the flaw in the logic of your friend is he thinks he's commandeering some type of high performance car. And he's going to get in that car and find out he can only go 20 miles an hour. So, and what I mean by that is there is some type of, intellectual nicety to saying, well, listen, all these businesses have generally, they all have some type of property insurance. And for those that have bought business interruption insurance in any form, or maybe even those that haven't, we'll just funnel the business losses through the insurance companies because they're set up for that. There's a policy there, you know. So, you know, if there was someone who didn't buy any policy, well, they're out of luck. And they should have bought a policy, so you have that outcome. The problem is the extent of the losses, the number of businesses that are involved in this, the massive hit to GDP, and the ongoing need to make these types of payments. There's only one entity, at least in the United States, set up with an infrastructure that can make that many payments that frequently, and that's the federal government. So you can take... And listen, travelers can call me and yell at me later, but you can take one of the most sophisticated, largest commercial insurance companies in the country, that being Travelers. And I think Travelers would say they would have a difficult time, I think, you know, fulfilling expectations of paying off everyone's business interruption losses through even with a government, you know, financial support through their infrastructure. That's a lot bigger haul than it sounds like.
Yeah.
I mean, the government's designed, right, through Social Security and through tax and through all that kind of stuff. They are designed to be able to make massive payments to the public as frequently as we need, or at least they're supposed to. So I still think that's the infrastructure to lean on if you're going to go for that type of solution, where it's a socialist, nationalist type of solution.
Yeah. How about this idea of what a realistic like worst case or lesser case would look like over the next couple of years? So we talk about what might go well. The word realistic. What do you think could happen that ain't good for the market or for trans?
Without a doubt, the worst case scenario, not just for trans, for the industry, is what we're kind of hinting at here, and that's government or legislatures retroactively push in business interruption coverage where none was intended.
Yeah.
To me, that's, I mean, what do they call it when the meteors supposedly wiped out the dinosaurs? The extinction level event.
Right? Sure. Yes.
That's an ELE. You know, the industry is not capitalized for that, nor will it ever be capitalized to take on a large portion of the damage done to GDP by a global pandemic. So now I don't think retroactive coverage is going to happen, but that's still not resolved. But that would be a very, very bad outcome for Transre and for everyone else in the industry. Outside of that, I think a worst case for us and many, many others, obviously, is that COVID losses kind of hit the higher end of some of these estimate ranges. Mm-hmm. And maybe the market has additional cats along the way. I mean, we're just entering into hurricane season as we speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
The reinsurance market either doesn't or can't appropriately react to those types of losses and exposures, meaning that we can't get enough price because it's not realistic, or we can't get improvements in structures because the market doesn't allow it, or, you know, whatever theory you want. The worst case scenario, realistic worst case, is COVID's bad. additional cat losses come in. And yeah, on the cat market or the casualty market, whatever market you want to point to, we get improvements, but we're still looking at a low ROE scenario.
You know, it's fascinating to me about the answers. And if I think your best case and worst case scenarios, is there actually a difference of kind, not really a difference of type, right? And so it's like the best case scenario, like we know we're going to get losses. The best case scenario is the losses are bad enough that it wakes us up, but not so bad that it takes us out. Right. And the worst case scenario is it takes us out.
That's right. It's a simple business, David.
It kind of is, right? I mean, it's terrifyingly simple.
Yeah. It really is.
How about different parts of the world? So the United States, talking a lot about US here. I know you've got experience in many parts of the world. From an insurance perspective, any different analysis or is it kind of similar everywhere?
With respect to COVID, I guess?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think that if you think about COVID and you think about, again, the business interruption exposure, that's the most relevant market changing type of exposure, I think. You know, there's differences in policy forms around the globe, and mm-hmm. that affects how it will resolve itself around the globe. So, for instance, I think it's fair to say that in the UK, Canada, perhaps continental Europe, we found a lot more policies than we thought existed, but we found a lot more policies where the markets were affirmatively granting coverage for communicable disease and the like than in the US. Mm. So presumably in those situations, you're going to have losses, but they're going to resolve more quickly if there's an agreement that coverage was in place. In the US, there is some affirmative coverage, and it's been written about, but I wouldn't say comparatively there's a lot of affirmative coverage compared to other parts of the globe. I mean, the vast majority of commercial policies in the US use ISO forms and ISO wording, which in my opinion clearly exclude the coverage. However, there's still, you know, a fair amount of manuscript property policies in the US and the global market that don't use ISO wording. So, you know, that's where a lot of time and energy and billable attorney hours are going to go to from this pandemic. Some manuscript wording, you know, will be unambiguous for sure. Other manuscript policies might clearly require physical damage to trigger business interruption or might be silent on excluding communicable disease. And there's going to be a dozen variations in between. So this is going to take a long time to play out in that part of the property market, the manuscript property market. And, you know, and given the US's litigiousness, it will be probably focused more in the US. Frankly, a lot of those manuscript policies are in place for larger, more sophisticated commercial entities. So they'll no doubt press hard for coverage.
Do you think so now that the pandemic's happened, right? So we all have this, you know, this availability bias, right? So we're all going to remember it. Imagine more people are going to buy insurance on it or something's going to happen. To what extent and how is this insurable, a pandemic? Is it a catastrophe?
Listen, I think it's insurable, but there's a lot of work to be done. Yeah. And practically, there's been, I think I read somewhere, there's been 10 or 11 large pandemics or epidemics worldwide in the last 100 years.
Yep.
You know, you could build a model off that.
Sure. Right? I mean, there's kind of sounds like the hurricane frequency, you know, the really Cat 5, say, making landfall. Probably can't be too many more than that, you know?
Yeah. So that's, that is doable. So for starters, you know, the insurance industry and other scientific bodies, you know, got to really put a lot of effort into the development of models. I mean, generally that's when insurance market solutions take hold, is when there's some type of modeling of frequency and severity behind the underwriting, even if they're minimally credible. So, you know, I don't know a lot about pandemic models, but, you know, I'm sure there's data out there. I'm sure it's inconsistent and hard to get to. But
I'm sure you're going to learn a lot about it now.
Yeah, you are going to learn it. So I think it's modeling. I think also that without a doubt, if society wants the insurance industry to provide solutions that are meaningful for business interruption losses, as the example we keep using, or hits to the GDP, well, then it's going to have to be some type of public-private partnership.
Right.
And, you know, again, the private industry cannot take on that type of exposure. Nor do I think it's smart that the, you know, various governments around the world just take on the exposure wholesale. I think when you you enter into a partnership and you have a solution that goes through the private market. The private market has the ability to, you know, seek price discovery, tailor coverages, provide incentives to mitigate and avoid risk. All those kind of good things come from the private market, not necessarily the public market. So I think a public-private partnership, whether you want to call it PREA or, you know, whatever, I think that's going to be a part of it. So if you get that, if you get a lot of work put behind pandemics, you know, I think it is insurable, but I think it's going to have to evolve over time.
How about evolving kind of political climate here? So we're, you know, protectionism, and it seems to me like a really pretty big story that there's going to be less international movement of people, capital, business than before. Any thoughts on that? How it might impact your business?
It's a good question. I mean, listen, I guess for I don't know how long of a period of time, there's going to be less movement of people, not because of protectionism, unless you define protectionism. I don't want to catch a virus on a plane.
Yeah.
Individual protectionism. In terms of, you know, the classical definition of protectionism, listen, I'm a free trader. So, you know, my personal position is that in terms of how trade affects business, including the insurance business, I'm definitely a free trader. I don't like protectionism. I don't like trade wars. I think the more easily capital, product, and people are able to move around the globe, the better, and the better it is for business. And therefore, kind of as a dyed-in-the-wool capitalist, the better it is for society. I know globalization, even before the pandemic, globalization is definitely not in vogue anymore.
Yeah.
And I understand the politics behind that sentiment. I also understand that the world just can't run on business principles, you know, and that times real-world conflicts emerge and measures such as sanctions and trade barriers and other protectionist measures are put in place. But in general, to your question, I believe the freer the trade, the more opportunity there is for insurers to grow and for insurers to provide better solutions and protect society against loss. But it, you know, it's a real thing, as you point out.
Do you think anything's going to change? Like anything, like 10 years from now, will be anything different about the insurance industry?
Well, think about 10 years ago. Was the insurance industry look like it does now? I mean, I think it's been changing a lot with technology and globalization and all the rest of it. So I think 10 years from now, it will definitely change in terms of, you know, how it changes specifically related to the effects of the pandemic or crisis. I'm not sure I'm clever enough to think about that thoroughly, but work environments, I think, are going to have to change.
Yeah,
or
sure. Change.
And I'm kind of fascinated by thinking about that. You know, if you're a business like Transry, you can probably go really far in creating mobile at home work environments and not lose out on productivity or results. And, you know, but you do lose something. I was talking to one of our InsurTech customers last month in the middle of the crisis. And we were talking about, you know, how's the operations going in the lockdown? And he says, oh, they're going great. You know, our productivity's high. Our operations are doing well. He has all kinds of KPIs that measure that. Mm-hmm. And then he said, but, you know, I don't have a KPI for creativity. And that's important for his business. And the ability for humans to interact in place or in a room or even at the water cooler kind of thing. He says, you know, we're losing that. And I'm worried about that. I thought that was an interesting thought. Hmm. So it's going to be interesting. I think there definitely, regardless of in our reinsurance industry, there's going to be a lot more at home work environments. And I think that's fine. I mean, our particular company, I mean, we're based in New York and our second largest location is in London. So it's a real life, real time challenge for us. And, you know, we're actively working with our employees and thinking about how we can create environments where we can still come to the office and collaborate, but allow a lot of flexibility for people to work at home should they need to, or they certainly in the short term if they don't feel comfortable coming back to work. So it's going to be an interesting thing to look at. It's easier. I think it's an easier situation for reinsurers over massive insurance companies, right? I mean, And I can't imagine how they're approaching the issue.
Because they have people concentrated in offices, and it's,
you know, I'm dealing with 650 people.
Yeah.
Now it might be in 25 different locations or whatever. And, you know, but still 650 people, and we're all, you know, we're not heavy file intensive. It's all online. So we can go a long way. If you're an insurance company that has 10,000 people, right? Obviously that's a quantum level more difficulty in terms of making sure your operations are done well. And also, you know, even for us, you have to think about going down the road. You're probably going to have to hire different types of people or people with different traits going forward. You know, one of the things that the good and the bad or the good and the interesting is, you know, when everyone's locked down at home, well, it's the experiment is on, right? Can you individual work at home? We have the technology for you in terms of communication and computers and iPhones and videos and all that kind of stuff. And does your at-home work environment allow for that? I mean, we're on video conferences all the time, as I'm sure you are. And I've been on video conferences where clearly one of our employees is in their laundry room. Right. I mean, because they have a small apartment in New York. So they got to do what they got to do. And other people are, you know, sitting outside by the pool. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting dynamic. And what we've discovered is it's good because people have got to kind of force their ways into how do I create an effective work environment for me at my home? And people are getting through that. It's interesting in that you kind of discover what people you have in the company that really struggle with technology.
Interesting.
And there are some, right? And it's not just necessarily, you know, the old guys like me, right? I mean, it's more random that some people have comfort with technology. Some people love technology. And some people you just thought maybe by an age group, oh yeah, they'll be fine. You find out that no, they're not that uncomfortable with it, you know? Yeah. So all that's going to change in terms of how you train your people, how you hire your people. So it's really going to be a very interesting thing writ large across the global economy.
Any patterns you're noticing, other patterns other than people who just can and cannot figure out, you know, you and I had a laugh at the beginning of this conversation about figuring out the technology that we're using right now. Any other patterns from workplace productivity that you've noticed, you know, if you could give some advice to yourself 2 months ago or 3 months ago, what would you say about just keeping folks as productive as possible in this environment?
You know, I don't think we have an issue. I can't speak for any other companies. I don't think we have an issue with productivity. I think we don't have a KPI for productivity. That's not the type of company we are. But I can just tell you that we know this for a fact, that our productivity as a team, global team, has never been higher. I mean, if we had a KPI, it's through the roof.
Yeah.
And we just know that. But there's a real downside to that, right? And that's more what we're focused on. That people are, because they're working in an at-home environment, you know, it's hard for me to get these words out of my mouth, but they're probably working too hard or too long. They're not taking, you know, breaks. They're not taking days off. Mike Sapner, our CEO, was just talking to me yesterday, and he said, and he's totally right. He's going to really insist that people take, you know, I want to know what week you're taking off and turning off everything and just getting away from it. I think that's right. So I think productivity is not the issue because of the way our business is structured in reinsurance, the way our company is at Transre, and because of technology. It's more how do you get people to get that balance where they're productive but not really burning themselves out.
Hmm. You mentioned London, and you know I spent some time in London earlier in my career, and much more face to face place. Right. I mean, Lloyd's, but also the legacy of Lloyd's, not all of the companies that you know, Trans isn't, I don't think you guys have Lloyd's Syndicate. You didn't anyway when I was there. And yet you meet people more often. Yeah. And that's, you know, this place is going to suffer more. I'm wondering what, if you have a theory for kind of like what that might do. Anything? Will it be found to have been all an illusion that, you know, they can work from home just as easily as we can? And now,
I don't know. Not being English, you know, I've been in the London market enough.
Yeah.
I remember years and years and years ago when I was in London, we stupidly moved our office outside of Lloyd's from the first floor to the fourth floor. We like lost 50% of our submissions.
Incredible.
Because brokers were unwilling to get in an elevator. So it's a really obviously historically, as you say, face-to-face market, and that's really important. I wouldn't know how they're going to adapt. I think that face-to-face market is great in so many ways. That's why I love going to London. Mm-hmm. And I would hate to lose that. On the other hand, it's very expensive. And, you know, that's been a perennial problem in Lloyd's and other places. And so I would hope that, you know, once we get through this pandemic, once there's, I don't know, some type of reasonable protections and, you know, mitigators put in place where you can actually get in a room with people and transact, you know, I would hope that Lloyd's would lead the way on how to do that.
It seems to me, you know, so as a broker, there is this article of faith, I guess, that you want to get in front of people and you want to talk to them about this. And you have this much more, a richer exchange of information. I mean, that's just like psychology of humans, right? When you're in person, you know, the body language, the nuance, all this stuff, right? And the question that kind of sits in my mind here is, what does that gain you from a productivity standpoint? Or how does that affect your loss ratio? Or your expense ratio, or I don't know. I mean, you're saying it's more expensive, but you know, is it more satisfying? And therefore, you know, what are the benefits? And you know, yeah. Having an eye out here for we're going to lose those benefits, Ken. And so, do we care? Right?
Yeah. I mean, I think we do. I mean, I think there, you know, like in everything in life, there's pluses and minuses to every business model and situation. And I think that face-to-face engagement, you know, is important. Right. I mean, I do think you work through problems easier. I think you come to successful outcomes more. I think you tend to make more definitive decisions when you're sitting with someone in a room with the goal of making a definitive decision versus on a phone. So I think there's a lot to that. I also think, harking back to my earlier comment about our InsurTech customer, I think there is a creativity. Mm-hmm. That we have to protect, and nowhere has been more creative in the insurance industry than London. And I'm sure some of that might, you know, might be a little more creative over a pint of beer, you know, or at least being in the same room with people than on a video conference. So I don't have the solution to that, but I think I would hate to wholesale lose that. I think the benefit to having more remote and again, video conferencing use technology is on the expense ratio. So that's the problem, right? You can't really quantify creative benefits to loss ratio and business outcomes. You can quantify the fact that you're not going to any industry conferences this year, right? Yep. I save X millions of dollars, right?
Yep.
So you don't want to get too carried away and let the accountants run your strategy. You know, there has to be some type of balance.
How does it feel? Yeah. So you can't put the accountants in charge for a bit. They're at least by proxy in charge now, right? So they're shutting everything down. Expense ratios are going down. What, so let's say this carries on for whatever, I don't know, a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. Well, how does it fail? What happens?
How does what fail?
How does this regime we're in now fail? Like if we don't ever go back, right? Yeah. So it's all remote, no relationship, you know, the relationship is still there, right? But you only what you can create online and over the phone. And creativity is, you know, whatever you wind up with that. What is the negative outcome that stops that from happening? Other than charismatic CEOs saying, too bad, we're switching back. You know, if the accountants really are in charge, they will never switch back unless they're forced to, right? So what would force them?
I mean, not picking on the accountants, I'm sure they would want to get back. What would force them? You know, that's the thing about insurance. The benefits of insurance is you don't get runs on the bank and people buy insurance. It's a critical product for the globe.
Sure.
If in a science fiction world, no one could leave their home for the next 5 years, insurance is still going to be providing products. And, you know, the services are going to be a little different. And I think ultimately the product development might be a little different. It might not be as quick. Or as creative, but I'm not sure. Kind of macro, you know, like staying at home has added 10 points to your loss ratio. We got to get back to New York and London. I don't think that happens.
Let me try. Let me try an idea. I was just kind of thinking about it as you were talking, honestly, which is maybe right now what we're doing is we're spending down relationship capital. We spend a lot of time together. We've developed these relationships with folks, and that lets you collaborate effectively. And pandemic starts and you stop all that relationship building. And now you're kind of, you know, you're managing these relationships through a straw, right? Through online and, you know, it's harder. And so eventually you just start getting along less with people and maybe more conflict in the workplace, maybe less employee satisfaction, people burn out. You know, you mentioned Mike there talking about that. Like what are the effects of burnout on an organization? Yeah. I'm not really sure, to be honest with you.
You know, your comment about, it's interesting, your comment about relationships is a real important one, certainly in reinsurance. You know, I can't tell you, and I know this holds for everyone, I can't tell you how many deals we might do based on trust, right?
Sure.
That a terrific broker partner or customer calls you and say, listen, we got a problem here, or we have an idea. We really like you to support this, et cetera, et cetera. There's no data to go on. There's, you know, or the data looks really bad and you just have to trust that they're executing in a different way or whatever the case may be. And, you know, if we're honest, if someone calls me who I really don't know, I'm less likely to agree to that than someone who I've been with, golfed with, had a couple beers with, worked with, you know, one personally over the years. Those kind of tough placements or creative ideas, I think generally get done between people who have a really good familiarity with each other and have a high level of trust. This may be go wrong, but if it goes pear-shaped, you know, you won't leave me out in the cold. You know, if you lose some or a lot of that down the road because you just don't know the people personally that you're working with, that will definitely have a negative impact for sure.
Hey, now you I think live on the West Coast, is that right?
Yes.
And so which is not really an insurance center, you know, compared to certainly New York, which is where Transre is headquartered, or London for that matter.
An insurance headquarters in my house.
Right. Okay. Certainly now. you've been coping this for a while with these related issues for some time. What can you teach us, Ken, about making it work?
Because it's I prior to Transre, I worked for GE, and GE was very. GE's done a lot of things wrong, obviously. But I used to brag that I worked for GE. Now I'm a little ashamed. But one of the things that I think they were progressive about is because it was such a large company, there was all kinds of opportunities to work remotely. And this goes back 20 years. And so I kind of grew up in an environment where, you know, you didn't have to be at the office. You could work from your home, or you had employees who didn't live near a metro center and they were working out of their home, and you just work these things out. And so me and actually a subset of people at Transre have been doing this for 20, 25 years. Wow. And you just, you kind of, I don't know, it becomes organic to you that you take the opportunity that when you're with people, like at a conference, you know, to really reconnect. Or, you know, at a cocktail party or a Christmas party or, you know, whatever the case may be, because you're not seeing those people Monday through Friday, right? So you might only see your colleagues, you know, 3-4 times a year. So you kind of make the most of it, you know, when you have the opportunity. You obviously work, again, the technology. You work phones hard. You work technology hard to make sure that you're connecting with your actuaries and claims peoples and everyone else to make the right risk decisions and all that. So it's there's no magic pill to it. But a big part of what's worked for me and people like me at our company for the last 20 years is definitely there is a mothership to go to. I work from the West Coast, but I'm in New York a lot, and I have an apartment in New York, and that's important. It's, you know, as a manager, you know, very difficult to do an effective management job if you aren't seeing your people and meeting with them and engaging with them and your customers. So, you know, I think the most important key to a mobile work environment is that you have the opportunity to not be mobile and go to that home office or go to that major office and interact with people. I mean, that's really important.
How about the technology as it's evolved over the course of your remote work history? Certainly been an explosion of innovation on that in the last period of time, and probably we're going to see a lot of it in the next few months. Anything that's been kind of really transformative over your career and making things easier?
Yeah, mobile technology has made everything phenomenally easier. I mean, when I started doing this, I used to have a beeper. Or, you know, a pager or whatever. And that seemed like that was pretty cool. And then of course, you know, cellular phones, and you had your flip phone, the first one to get the Nokia flip phone. And then, you know, oh my God, what's this BlackBerry? And, you know, and then the iPhone and Android kind of just wiped everything away. And so the mobile technology wave, the ability to really fly anywhere with your iPad and have everything from all your work emails and files and movies and books all, you know, in a 9x11 thin tool, that's changed everything. You can be connected and you can have access to all your important information wherever you're at. And so that's huge. And I think what COVID is doing is now it's going to push, I think, improve technology, work technology at home. So, you know, I don't want to work on my iPad at home. I want to work on my desktop, and I want to have an effective teleconference speaker, and I want, you know, strong Wi-Fi, and whatever the case is, whatever the tools that we need, I think that's going to probably, and video conferencing, you know, I think that's going to improve and be adopted fairly rapidly.
Do you have any routines that make this easier, this remote work that you rely on, that you've developed over the years?
Routines in terms of work, not really. I do, you know, because I've been doing this a long time, and out on the West Coast, and to your point, it's not really a hub of reinsurance or insurance. I've always had a pretty effective at-home work office. That's always been pretty important to me. So when COVID hit, people, like I said, were scrambling in their laundry rooms to create some space and get a Wi-Fi signal. I always had... You know, I have a separate building, separate area on my property, and I can come here and it's a regular office and I have everything I need. And I think there's a handful of people in our company who are similarly situated. And I think what COVID does is it shows people who think that they're going to probably want to, if not have to, work from home for extended periods of time. They have to create that kind of environment within their own homes some way. And so our company is going to provide them whatever they need. But I think larger, these types of industries that serve those types of products are gonna have to improve, and they will improve their product offerings.
And how about with respect to like relationships? I think of this as, you know, one of the things that I try and do is keep in touch with people. In order to do that, you know, as you pointed out, if you're running across them all the time, especially in London, then you know, it happens quite naturally. You just talk to them, right? Yeah. But if you're trying to keep in touch with people, you know, maintain those relationships you're talking about. And maybe it's as simple as you look for folks at a conference because you're part of your, it's sort of served up to us as an industry. We're kind of throwing each other together all the time. And that, you know, you just said, go with the flow still. Let the kind of, I don't know, the culture carry us forward. Seems to be a lot of that.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of, not business wise, but important to the business. You know, we're doing a lot of things socially online together, groups of employees, groups of brokers, some customers. You know, we have groups who do Peloton challenges all throughout the week, and God knows why they do that, but it looks like they're having fun.
I say they are. It doesn't look like fun.
We have a bunch of kind of movie buffs in our company. And we've kind of stolen the idea from Bill Simmons, the, you know, ex-ESPN famous broadcaster who has a podcast called The Rewatchables. And what he does is him and his crew tee up a movie, you know, like once a week, and like Jaws, right? And they'll go through the movie. They won't play the movie, but the podcast will be all about Jaws, and they'll have all kinds of trivia and what happened and all the rest of it. And that's kind of fun to listen to. So we've had someone in our IT department who's created our own Rewatchables Club, and that's a lot of fun, right? 30 people, 30, 40 people sign online. It's all video. They've been assigned a movie to watch, like a kind of virtual book club. So there's a lot of that stuff going on. It feels like it's fun. It's good for the morale. It's good for the connectivity. Doesn't feel permanent to me though. Right.
Yeah, like right.
Replacements while you're locked in place. So, you know, these are hard questions. If the future is more at home in our industry, how, I don't think you do replace the benefits of these in-person engagements. I just think it's impossible. So we're going to have to see how it works out.
Yeah. I mean, I remember reading a piece about New York City that was written after in like 1921 or 1922, right after the Spanish flu pandemic, which was real bad. Right. Yeah. And saying, oh, New York's dead. Right. Nobody will ever want to live there or work there because of the flu. And, you know, up until 6 months ago, that's like laughable. But right. We're seeing similar things again. Although I think it is probably the case that society would never have locked down without remote work technology, right? We would have just had to ride it out. I don't think they locked anything down, or maybe who knows what they did. I actually don't know what they did in the Spanish flu, but you know, it becomes easier when a lot of people can actually work from home to actually make these kinds of, you know, take these measures.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I also agree with your analogy. I mean, I do think there's an enormous resiliency to kind of humankind and its need to socialize and get beyond these kind of things. And so, you know, you can get quite depressed watching news channels and only reading worst case scenarios all the time, which we tend to do in insurance and reinsurance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I am not going to be surprised if, you know, whether you want to call it a V-shaped recovery or not, you know, whether that happens or not, I do think that, you know, society will get through this. And we'll get through it, you know, as strong, if not stronger, because of the need to socially interact with each other. And capitalism is a very strong force that, you know, can work through these things. And I think our industry will be no different.
So we're actually kind of running out of time here, but I want to tie back in closing to this sort of original idea of looking forward and thinking about how we pull through this and wondering, actually, you know, I've got this sort of idea that I like to think about, which is the idea of people assessing their risk based on how risky the last, you know, 5 years were. Right. Yeah. And, you know, now looking back, certainly next year, looking back, it's going to look pretty bad. You know, do you think that that's actually going to change how people buy insurance, buy reinsurance? Like, should investors be excited about this? And, you know, insurance executives as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll go back to my original answer on the first question. I'm fairly bullish. I think it's good to be in reinsurance right now.
Yeah,
I'll say that. And I haven't been able to say that for some time. And it's not just a crass, oh, I think I'm getting more price.
Yes.
I just think that there's going to be a lot of appropriate measures taken across a broad spectrum of product lines and regions that improve the risk return calculation for the industry. And so whether you're talking about property cat or casualty, U.S. casualty, there was already a fair amount of momentum building in a lot of this. And like I said, COVID is just going to push it forward, I think, harder and longer. And, you know, to another of your questions, I don't think we'll overreact. There's always that, you know, potential that you overreact, that you build an entire return model based upon $100 billion COVID loss and it comes in at $20 billion. It's never going to be that clear. But what is clear is going into COVID, you know, certainly on reinsurance, we were not getting appropriate returns for the exposures we were taking on. But it was building momentum to get better returns. And I think what COVID does is it allows us to actually get appropriate returns.
So one thing that strikes me actually about the line of thinking is that you haven't really talked about supply and demand in your observations here. And so, which I quite like as a framing, because to me, I mean, there must be something like dumb capital, but I think people overrate that answer. That said, there might be a class of 2021.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, right. Startups or at least sidecars or gosh knows what, who knows who's raising capital. A lot of people are, right. Allegheny issued a bunch of bonds, your parent company. So maybe capital will be pouring into the industry. Is that,
it's always a fear.
Yeah. Right.
But, you know, listen, I mean, look at, I know it's early, but if you look at the Florida property cat renewal in June, which is kind of a bellwether for a lot of things, you know, rates went up significantly. Coverages were limited in a lot of cases. There was a host of shortfall requests, non-concurrent terms, and kind of no one really showed up to kind of blunt that type of improvement, right? Mm. I mean, there's a couple markets out there that could have shown up and said, right, we're all in, and kind of dampened all those improvements. And it didn't happen. They could have, but I think they saw it too, that you know, we got to get better returns on that particular product in that particular region. But listen, that's the epic challenge of our industry. There are no barriers to entry, right? And capital is going to go where capital is going to go. And we've kind of benefited and suffered from that all at once in our industry. But we'll see where that capital goes. That capital might not be interested going into an industry with cyber and wildfires and pandemics and the threat of legislative rewrites. And they might just say, well, let's buy some more equity, you know, because the equity market's rebounding. So it's an unknown, but you're right. We didn't really talk about supply and demand, but there's always the prospect of, you know, a class of 2021 happening.
Indeed. Well, my guest today is Ken Brandt. Ken, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, David.